This podcast is brought to you by Craft Beer and Brewing Magazine for those that love to make and drink great beer. To learn more or to subscribe, visit beerandbrewing.com or find us on social media at Craft Beer Brew. It's episode 348 of the Craft Beer and Brewing Podcast. Thanks for joining me on this special fermentation-focused episode brought to you interruption-free by the yeast and fermentation specialists at White Labs. If you brew beer, you're familiar with White Labs. They've been supplying brewers with the highest quality yeast and fermentation aids for many, many years and now serve brewers around the world from outposts in San Diego and Asheville in the United States, as well as Copenhagen and Hong Kong. Through today's episode, we'll focus on the keys to effective fermentation, from yeast health to enzymes and more. Joining me for this conversation are White Labs founder Chris White. Welcome to the podcast, Chris.
Hello, thank you. Happy to be here, Jimmy.
It's great to have you on, and first time here on the podcast. Also joining me, Beechwood Brewing co-owner, brewmaster Julian Schrago. Welcome back to the podcast, Julian.
Jamie, thank you. It's an honor to be here with everybody, and I look forward to all the chat.
It'll be fun. And then Russian Riverhead brewer Garrison Fratoni, great to have you on the podcast as well.
Hey, Jamie. Super stoked to be here. A long time listener. Long time. So excited to be here with everybody.
Appreciate that. We had a great time hanging out at the Brewers Retreat earlier this year as you were helping make everything happen for us. Of course, Russian River and White Labs have a long history together. A couple weeks ago, and I was talking with Vinny Chalurzo, who was recounting to me stories of street corner yeast pickups back in the very early days of his brewing and your lab, Chris. Why don't we kick things off with a bit of White Labs background? Of course, starting a yeast lab for craft brewers and home brewers was not exactly a safe business bet back when you got into it. It was certainly a labor of love. What drove your interest in yeast and fermentation, and how did that evolve into the worldwide business that it is today?
Well, I don't think I really knew what I was doing, but I was just trying to homebrew and kept making yeast and kept giving it to people. And then over the years, a business developed out of that. But, when I first moved to San Diego in 1991, I started homebrewing in 1992 with the people who would end up starting Ballast Point. But they had started a homebrew store in San Diego called Homebrew Mart in 1992, Jack White and then Youssef Chardet. Attorney came on and popped into the store after they opened, and we just became friends and we started homebrewing. And I was in a yeast lab. I was working towards a PhD in yeast, a yeast called Pichia pastoris, working on really enzyme kinetics. But I had a passion for beer and brewing. I took some brewing classes as an undergrad at UC Davis. And I just wanted to find out about all grain brewing, really, was my interest in going in the store. But just the way it worked, I started really doing more yeast, cause that was my passion and microbiology and what yeast could do to fermentation. And so Youssef and I, mostly brewing every weekend, we're just trying to make the best beer possible. And in that pathway became the beers for Ballast Point and the yeast for White Labs.
And of course, yeast and brewing was a different question back then. It was a more basic question than now, in terms of range and in terms of understanding of how yeast function in these fermentations, quite a bit more developed.
It's been that way for a long time. Yeah, right. So when I started homebrewing, I had really hard access to yeast. So really, for me, it was about making my own, because that's how I could. So starting to acquire strains and just trying to make better homebrew, not thinking about a business plan or a business. It was well before that. Like I said, I sort of stumbled into it, but I didn't even know how to start a yeast lab or if that was even possible. But on the beer side, I mean, it goes back a long time. When Louis Pasteur said yeast causes fermentation, he didn't think it had anything to do with the beer quality. You know, that kind of came later. Emil Christian Hansen purifying yeast in Copenhagen. So now pure yeast, in those words, were about one strain. Now we kind of think, are we talking about no bacteria or no other yeast? I mean, it was really pure. That definition in 1883 was one strain being used to make beer and growing, propagating that one strain up. And so that's where people started saying, hey, yeast the yeast itself can have an impact on the beers. Even though that was what brewers knew, it started making its way into what we do today. And it's, like I said, I'm just saying it goes way back that far. So even now, me as entering as a brewer and everybody else entering as a brewer, you have that experience where you start using different yeast going, huh, they have a different impact on the beer.
Sure, sure. And so, you know, it just kind of grew organically then. And, you know, then you have grown and expanded, created options in the commercial brewing space. And, you know, as craft brewing has taken off, grown along with that.
Yeah. And Vinny was part of that early San Diego community, starting to homebrew in Temecula at his family's winery, going to Homebrew Mart, starting a brewery in Temecula. And I just started supplying him yeast. I'm not really sure how it happened, but he would drive down to San Diego and I would walk down from my, well, there was no cell phones, right? So it's about an hour drive. When he got to San Diego, he would call me from the gas station. He'd have to go to a payphone.
Yeah.
Tell me he was there. We didn't think it was any that big a deal at the time, but I would walk downstairs and give him some yeast and maybe he'd give me a few bucks. Some of it was trade and other breweries in San Diego, pizza trade at Pizza Port. But when we knew it was kind of weird was when he asked other people to start picking up the yeast for him. And they'd be like, what am I going to do? I'm going to stop at a gas station and call him and it's going to feel like a drug transfer down to the parking lot. But to us, it was just what we had been doing for a couple of years, you know? So it didn't seem too weird.
Perfectly normal.
That's a little weird now.
I love that it's a, you know, it's this story, you know, on the yeast side that parallels the craft beer story, right? Like we couldn't get this beer style and so we have to brew it ourselves. Well, we couldn't get this yeast propagation and so we've got to make it ourselves and that kind of DIY, make it happen because no one else is going to make it happen for us. Ethos, you know, still pervades now. Well, obviously, you know, the craft beer world is much more developed now. There is, you know, in terms of where White Labs is going, I imagine now you're producing more strains than you've ever had and more, you know, different formats, you know, different kinds of ways. All of these things that the brewers need to, you know, achieve highest quality fermentations. You know, what are, you know, maybe we kick off, what are some of the big trends, you know, that you're seeing right now, you know, within White Labs? What are some of the big things that are moving brewers that you all are now focusing on, you know, to answer some of that interest?
Well, I think for most of all of our, you know, whatever 30 so year history and shorter or longer has been growing capacity. You know, like every brewery I've known has been trying to grow their capacity, add new fermenters. We've been trying to grow. That's why we have the two and three other facilities, making yeast, making more strains. You know, I think the first different kind of style for us was Hefeweizen, you know, when that used to be a specialty style. And then all the breweries in the 90s needed Hefeweizen yeast. So it became a big thing for us. And every new style, even though they're not new, right, but they're just something craft brewers are making. And sometimes they're new now, but requires us to kind of invest in new space for new yeast strains. Because if everybody needs them, it's actually, even if it's only one beer a certain brewery makes, if everybody needs it, it's a lot of yeast for us to make. So we've always just been focusing on growing more yeast, growing them more healthy, growing just so they can express their best flavors and we can get them to the brewers. Now, it is a little different. Breweries don't have as much capacity expansion. It's like, what can we do to make something that people want to drink? And a lot of that's non-beer right now. So we're doing a lot more with yeast for distilling and cider. I think there's still something that hasn't been discovered yet that craft brewers will make that will get big. Maybe some kind of hybrid thing between beer and one of these other styles. But younger consumers, 21 to 25 year olds, are, you know, just looking for something other than craft beer right now. I mean, I remember in 2008 being at this kind of tap room grocery beer to go place in Davis, California, visiting up there. We had a lab there for 10 years too. And I was in the beer area and two young female students, everyone is a UC Davis student, right? Were saying, where's the Pliny? where's the Pliny? So it's funny for this group. And I'm like, oh, young people are noticing Pliny, young female students. And that was the beginning of 10 years of growth, because young people noticed craft beer. And they're just not asking maybe for that right now in that age segment. So what are they asking for? And that's kind of what we're trying to focus on for yeast and mixed cultures and things, what people might need.
So you're making more yeast that can ferment hard seltzer right now, or and then also, you know, are the growth of RTDs, which means, you know, making fermenting that then, you know, can be distilled into, you know, neutral base, you know, for those kinds of RTD beverages. No, you know, it's something that lots of brewers are certainly facing out there right now, too. However, beer is still a pretty strong baseline in that, right?
Beer is not going away.
Yeah.
It's just, what could you dabble in right now to keep your company going and get some growth?
Beer plus, you know, it's still the base on that. Well, you mentioned yeast health, you know, and you propagating yeast at a large scale in order to produce healthy yeast and, you know, that's going to perform for brewers. Viability and help these fermentations is obviously a big piece. Talk to me a little bit about, you know, what that means for you all and how you all have been working on systems to kind of scale, but also produce healthy yeast at a larger scale.
Yeah. So I haven't deviated that much since 1995 in how we grow the yeast. 21-day process, small batch. So what I focused on was just more and more reactors and try to keep them small batch. Because you want to, you know, if we have a bunch of different batches every day coming off, we can keep the viability high, the purity, and a lot of variety of yeast strains. So we don't just make a big batch of yeast and then make another one and then another one. We have, you know, 40 here, 40 there, 40 every day. So, and that adds up to all the different strain varieties we have. So that's how I grew our capacity, was just bigger and bigger spaces and facilities, but kind of the same production model, where a brewery might just go, okay, I'll take my 10 barrel system to a 100 barrel system. I'll put 400 barrel fermenters in, and they can scale that way. I didn't really scale that way. I scaled more with square footage and people.
Lots of parallel growth fermentation, exactly, rather than just, you know, growing the scale of the individual propagations.
Right.
Interesting. You know, are there specific, you know, yeasts that have driven a lot of growth over the last few years for you?
Well, I mean, hazy, you know.
Making more London ale variants than you've ever done before? Or?
Yeah, our London fog yeast, it became a top seller when we came out with it. Even more in Europe than it is here in the U.S. And a couple of years ago, visiting our Copenhagen facility, they kept giving me hazy after hazy when we'd go out and try some beers. And I said, is there anything else other than hazy beers here? And he looked at me and they said, isn't that what you guys are drinking in the U.S.? Yeah, but we also have some lagers and we have some, you know, some Belgian styles, you know. So it's funny how these the styles just go all over the world. And so that had a tremendous impact on I think everybody's brewery. Everybody started having to make very heavily dry hopped beers in new ways, using new strains or new methods to keep them hazy. It was nonstop for a long time. I think something that seems similar to that in a different way was saisons. When saisons, I don't know, more than a decade ago, got popular. We were releasing new yeast strains for saisons. Everybody was making saisons. They were that hazy. They were that Belgian kind of, for lack of a better word, phenolic flavor beers coming on. But then that's when hazies got popular. That's when we saw a decrease in the interest in saisons.
Interesting. And maybe saison will come back. I keep my fingers crossed. Yeah. I've been drinking more these days, you know, just because it's counter trend. But yeah, we'll see about that one. Well, let's talk a little bit about, or let's get into the subject of healthy fermentation, since we're kind of there already at the yeast scale. You know, as healthy fermentation transitions into, you know, the commercial brew house, maybe Julian, you can kick off, you know, some of our talk about how you set up healthy fermentations, you know, whether that's starting on the hot side before the fermentation ever begins, or some of your, you know, pre-prep process as you are getting ready to, you know, set up a healthy fermentation coming in, out of the hot side of the brew house. Talk to us a little bit about your process around that. Some of the things that you focus on and some of the ways that you start setting up those healthy fermentations, because it's not just when you load it into the fermentation tank, that healthy fermentation starts even earlier than that.
Absolutely. I do want to quickly say I was in Belgium a couple months ago with my wife, and we found almost no saisons available like anywhere. It's a style that has really, really diminished in perhaps popularity, but certainly in production, even in Belgium, they're kind of scarce. But when it comes to yeast health and fermentation, the number one, the first thing that I look at, not the only thing that I look at, but the first thing I look at is cadence and a repitching rhythm and frequency. And in general, our house ale yeast, which is White Labs Cal Ale Yeast, in general, that gets repitched every 5 days on the early end, but and maybe on the eighth or ninth day on the long end. But in general, it gets repitched on a weekly cadence. And so the first thing that I look at is how frequently and how regularly am I going to be able to repitch that yeast and keep momentum going, kind of like a biological momentum, if you will, because it certainly makes a difference. If you pitch a yeast into a beer and then you maybe wait 10 days or 14 days before you repitch it, you may have gone way past any kind of terminal gravity into the point where the yeast's health is really, really suffering. We've certainly seen that before, more often with lager fermentations where we're not brewing them as frequently, but frequency is the first thing that I look at.
What's a sense of, what goes wrong with those when you don't get the rhythm right?
When you don't get the rhythm right, a couple of things can happen. If you try and harvest too early, you won't have enough cells there. Fermentation won't be complete enough, and not enough yeast cells will have either flocculated or, you know, really dropped out of suspension. So your harvest is going to be really poor and not dense enough. You won't have the cells for the next fermentation. The other thing that you look at if you wait too long before harvesting and repitching is viability and vitality both decrease. The amount of healthy cells that you have and the general overall health of those cells diminishes with every day that passes. So cadence is super important. And then also looking at volume of yeast, making sure that at least in a production environment, that at least once a week, I'm brewing a batch of beer large enough to supply all of the batches the following week. So volume is another thing too. And most of the fermenters at our production facility are 45 barrel fermenters. And in general, I will get enough yeast off of one 45 barrel fermentation to pitch into anywhere from 5 to 10 45 barrel fermentations the next week. So as long as I have one large batch of beer, you know, kind of at the beginning of each week, I know I'm good for the next week. And then also looking at how many generations you're carrying the yeast, because you start getting further along and things like bud scarring become more of a significant issue. The chance for mutation or mutations becomes more likely, and the characteristic and reliability, predictability of the yeast starts to diminish once you get too many generations in. And so for us, we play it fairly safe, and we usually prop up a new pitch every 6 to sometimes 10 generations, 6 on the early side, 10 on the latter side. And then another thing that I look at too is what is the strength of beer that I'm repitching into? What is the strength of the beer that I'm going to be depending on to harvest from? And there are certain styles of beer, certain alcohol percentages where we know the yeast is going to be terminal, where we know we're not going to harvest from that type of beer. And there are also certain high alcohol styles that we aim to go in at a very specific generation, because we just observationally and kind of, qualitatively, we've observed that maybe third or fourth generation is the strongest and most apt to reliably ferment a barley wine or a triple IPA, for example. But those are a couple common things that we look at. But in the production environment, repitching frequency is the first thing I look at.
Yeah, Garrison, talk to us about the Russian River approach there and how you set up these successful fermentations.
I think Julian really hit the nail on the head as far as just that cadence in the brewery. I hear a lot of similar practices, and we're really looking at Gen 6. We want to get something else into the propagator, just so that when we do step up to, say, our single batch tanks of 75 barrels, we know that we're going to have 300 barrels worth of yeast by the time we get to Gen 8, Gen 9. So love all that. But for us, obviously, we'll just start in the brew house. I think, good, clean wort is a big part of it. We want to make sure we have kettle findings in a place that's going to separate all those, heavy molecular rate proteins, polyphenols, and make sure that we have good, clear wort going into the fermenter. pH, aeration, pitching rate, I'm not saying anything near there. I think, part of the conversation today, and I'm really interested to get, Dr. White and Julian's take on zinc. I think Julian and I had a phone call a couple months back. Zinc's a hard one for craft brewers. It's a hard one.
Well, tell us more about that. Zinc. It sounds like such an easy supplement that I just take a pill for to keep my body health rolling correctly. What talk to me about what this focus on zinc is, what it means, what it means when it's deficient. What the negative effects of that, and how you all then use zinc through the fermentation process to ensure healthier fermentations.
As we slowly started to learn more, we knew we didn't need this full spectrum yeast nutrient anymore. In the day of IPA and high fan malts and all malt brewing, we didn't need a lot of the other things that were coming in yeast nutrition. So we stripped it down, and we see more and more craft brewers moving to, usually like a zinc sulfate. So with that, you're adding a whole heck of a lot less, and we can't measure it, right? ASPC methods for measuring zinc in solution are pretty pricey. It's an ICP machine. It's atomic spec. It's a very expensive analysis and not practical for a craft brewer to really measure in the brewery. So it's hard. I think if we were tackling any problem and say, hey, measure first. When we don't have the ability to measure, we have to kind of look elsewhere, use other tools, use the literature, look at folks like White Labs that can perform this analysis for us and get their guidance on how we dose.
Yeah, and I will say that, zinc is more or less the only nutrient that we use in the brewery these days, unless we're doing something that is very, very adjunct heavy. Or might be low in barley malt, like a Hefeweizen. In that case, we do use a little bit of yeast X because the fan levels are just not quite there with a grist that's 60% wheat malt. But in general, at my production facility, I'd say 99% of what we do, zinc is the only nutrient that goes in there. And kind of, we've been using zinc for several years on the hot side. And it was really kind of through using a couple different lager strains and seeing some inconsistencies in fermentation and really kind of stripping things down and changing the malt, like that beer flavor didn't go away, changing the hops, are we getting hops? Anyway, seeing some recurring flavors that I was becoming acutely aware of and not liking, and then also tasting those same flavors in other people's beers with similar yeast and processes and thinking, well, you know what? Like we haven't done a deep dive on zinc and how we're dosing it. And we kind of tore up the blueprint for how we were dosing zinc based on conversations with White Labs and then Garrison and then a couple other large breweries who've invested in a lot of lab work quantifying these things, like Sierra Nevada, New Belgium, having conversations with them about how they dose zinc. But we completely retooled our zinc dosing. It's now all done on the cold side. We don't administer it quite the same as Russian River does, but one thing that we're doing now is I bought a really large instant pop, which is basically an autoclave, and a whole bunch of autoclavable half-pint bottles, laboratory autoclave bottles. And I pre-mix the solution in acidified water so the zinc dissolves really well. And then I can batch those and make like a week or a week and a half's worth of zinc dosing solutions all at once. And my guys can just grab that, pour it in the top of the fermenter or through an accessory port, and that's it. Like it's ready to go. A lot of people can do this very easily in advance.
How do you all do it, Garrison?
Yeah, we're, you know, very similar as far as batching, you know, 1 liter autoclavable jugs, little RO water. We found when we first introduced it with just our typical HLT water, we, you know, we thought what we saw was a little bit of chelation and saw some sedimentation. So we went to RO, we got it in solution a little bit better, autoclaved it. And we probably over-engineered it a little bit, but, you know, what we have right now is actually a three-inch sight glass with a couple of valves. And we hooked that up to a peristaltic pump and actually dunes right in line on the cold wort side. So
That's smart. You know, that makes sense.
Maybe unnecessary, but we enjoyed coming up with that solution and been really happy with the results. I mean, just as far as looking at those rates and talking about all the loss on the hot side, you know, I think Julian and Russian River make very heavily hopped years. And so just the amount of loss you can get on the hot side, you know, 40 to 60% in literature as far as, you know, what you're losing just to that true pile before you actually get in the fermenter.
And so apropos to that, when I talked to Sierra Nevada about dosing zinc, they do still perform it on the hot side. I hope I'm not giving away any trade secrets. They still perform it on the hot side, but they have a very extensive lab and they've correlated the losses that they regularly see on average in wort, and they compensate for that. And that works for them. And Chris, I'm sure you can attest to the fact that zinc rates, while there is a general range, some yeast are way more sensitive to zinc levels than others, and some benefit quite a bit more. I read in a couple places in some older publications that lager yeast requires half the zinc of ale yeast, but that wasn't really substantiated by anything, or there wasn't any supporting hypothesis like it requires less because of this biological reason. We found the opposite. We found that our lager strains are much more sensitive to zinc deficiencies, and we have to hit that certain level. Like, I don't worry. If I left out zinc entirely, I wouldn't worry about getting a clean beer out of certain ale yeast. It might not land in exactly the place that I want, but I wouldn't be overly concerned with it. With a lager strain, if we left out zinc, I'd be like, it's anybody's guess as to where this one ends up.
Yeah. It's a fascinating topic. I mean, I could talk forever. I'd love that these guys are really dialed in because it has an impact on their beers. Look, most craft brewers aren't doing anything with zinc, and you don't have to make beer. That's the important thing, right? You don't have to with fermentation. So many of the things we could talk about fermentation, you don't have to. But if you want to try to make some of the world's greatest beers, this is what makes the difference. This is what makes a difference in fermentation, yeast health, flavor, flocculation. But if you don't, your fermentations look okay. As mentioned, it's really hard to measure zinc. And for most of brewing's history, you couldn't. So when you can't measure something, it's very hard to control something. So everybody talk about pitching rate. Okay, that's cool. You can measure that. But it turns out that zinc and oxygen levels are very much harder to measure, have a huge impact on how the yeast grow. It's not just what you add. The yeast has to grow. That's where the flavors come from. That's where beer comes from, yeast growth. So these kind of details are really important if you want to just move beyond, you know, good beer to great beer. And also, you know, remove some of those little problems that happen once in a while, which do cost you money. Because when you have better fermentations, you have less troubleshooting to do for problem fermentations. So it's not a new topic. When I started, you know, like I said, going to meetings and stuff 30 years ago, the old timers were talking about, hey, the secret, you know, to fixing fermentation problems was a little zinc powder. And then I had a talk with, you know, the famous Dr. Michael Lewis, right? Most people know him from the first UC Davis brewing professor, still in Davis, and retired, right, of course. But anyway, 1963, right, coming on to UC Davis as a brewing professor. And we had a talk in the 90s or early 2000s when we were working on zinc, that he said something very interesting. why does zinc addition make a difference? There should be enough zinc from the malt, right? We're going back to these numbers, you know, what's supplied by the malt. So why is it making a difference? He said something very smart. He said, it must be deficient, but we don't know why, because it wouldn't be making a difference in fermentation. So, you know, been worked on for a long time. And then, you know, with dry hop beers and hop creep being a bigger factor with all these tremendous amounts of hops used, it's have a resurgence of interest because it can reduce hop creep time because yeast are more healthy. They're doing everything better. And I guess just sort of one more story interrelated here is after Jamil Zanishev and I wrote that yeast book back in 2010, he started Heretic Brewery. And after a couple of years, they were having some fermentation problems. And his brewers were like, oh, this, that, this. He said, let's just focus on the fundamentals we just wrote about. So they dialed in their oxygen concentration. And this was before we were measuring zinc. So Heretic was next to Anheuser-Busch in Fairfield. They nicely measured the zinc form. And it was zero. And they were adding zinc. They were adding nutrients in, you know, in the whirlpool, into boil, whirlpool, like people do, and just wasting their money. And they thought, oh, okay, let's add on the cold side. And other people were talking about it too. And so the next time I went back to Heretic to visit, the brewers were almost laughing and giddy at how great everything was going. Their oxygen was right. Their zinc was right. And now, you know, they had just made a 12% barley wine with California ale yeast, and just saying how clean it was and how all those little fermentation problems went away. But these were things that were hard to fix before if you didn't know they needed to be dialed in. So Heretic did the same thing, started autoclaving, autoclaving a zinc solution, stock solution to make it sterile, adding it in with the yeast pitch and seeing really quick results. That's exactly why we did Servomyces over, you know, in the early 2000s, over 20 years ago with Lallemand, because in order to protect zinc from the hot side into the cold side. We just never thought of adding it on the cold side back then, I guess.
So for Julian, I'm curious about that. Like, why, obviously going through this autoclave process to make sure that you're, you know, putting in clean and zinc into your cold side. Like, it seems like that's a more difficult process, obviously, than adding it hot side where that he is going to sterilize it. And obviously there's some mix, but it's curious. I mean, how fast does the zinc degrade under that heat? And, it does still apparently work on a Sierra Nevada side. Why go to this cold side trouble that you do? So and it's I know, not I'm sure you've done it both ways.
Sure. You look at me. Of course I've done it both ways. That's not a Friday night confession, by the way. It's not that zinc gets destroyed on the hot side. It's that zinc gets bound up in trube proteins and solid matter that settles in the whirlpool before the wort is transferred to the fermenter. So it gets bound up in basically stuff that you're going to dump. And on average, I think most studies show that roughly 60% of the zinc that you add on the hot side gets bound up in the trube. Yeah, you can compensate for that up front. However, I still think, you know, I still think it's a much more efficient pathway. I'm hypothesizing a little bit here, but when you add it on the cold side, when you've separated nearly all of that trube or effectively all of it, I think it creates a much more efficient pathway for that zinc to go into solution and to make its way to the yeast in short order. And it's really not that much extra work. It takes me maybe 15, 20 minutes to batch these things once a week. It's really no extra time for my brewers. It's putting a valve on a tank and an elbow and pouring stuff in, or they get up on top of a fermenter and add it. We don't add it directly to the brink. I'm not sure I would want to risk any kind of overexposure or toxic exposure adding it directly to the yeast, even if we immediately get it injected and homogenized with the beer. But adding it on the cold side is not really a big deal. And then the other time when we do add it on the hot side is when we do high gravity brewing. So for example, one of our year-round lagers, we do two turns of high gravity wort. Those go to the fermenter, and then our whirlpool tank gets filled with hot liquor, just hot water. It's at sterilization temps. In those instances, we will add it directly to what we call a water back, because it's not going to get bound up in any tube or solid matter. And that, we're confident, efficiently makes its way into the fermenter in the full predicted dose that we're looking for.
Sure. So, Garrison Julian mentioned that, lager, counter to the conventional logic, is a important style to focus on. That, you all brew a range of styles, from Belgian styles to IPA, of course, and lager as well. Do you find that there are specific styles that you alter dosage on, or, vary, amplify, or even dial back where it's less necessary? Or are there other kind of recipe parameters that drive the way that you think about those zinc additions?
I'll say one thing. I think we got lucky. We kind of had some base rates, and when we made that conversion hot side to cooled side, I didn't touch them. I redid the map. I said, okay, well, if at anything, I'm going to go from 0.15 ppm to 0.25 ppm. And by all intensive measurements in literature, that's going to be a good thing. We saw fermentation performance improve. So we did try to quantify it. I think it's inherently hard to try to measure what you actually add to the wort and what you actually get to the fermenter, because there can't be yeast present. You have to have these kind of specialized water samples sent off, it's inherently hard to measure that and feel very, very good that it's homogeneous. So we kept things the same, and we monitored just our process. Joe Hertrick said it on an MBA podcast, and he's like, I could look at a malt COA and, 140 beta-glucan may mean something to one person, but if it works in my process, then it works. And, just look at the things in your process that you are familiar with, how they perform. And so we made that dosage. We monitored the performance of the process and felt good with it. Take that to the lager side. We started to see some, what we thought were symptoms of over adding zinc. So the literature says, stuff about having very concrete type slurries on the bottom of your tank. So we got our yeast slurry back into the brink, and instead of being, in the 1 to 1.4 billion cells per mil, we were in 2-3 billion cells per mil. And it was very concrete. We could barely move it with a positive displacement pump. So we were like, maybe we overdid it. And so we just backed it off just a little bit and watched again. And when we're talking about these additions, we're talking half a gram to a 75 barrel batch of beer. So you just have to know that these numbers are super, super tiny, and it doesn't take much. And when we are measuring this bare bone nutrient at a 5 to 7 gram amount in a 75 barrel batch of beer, it's quite a bit. So you just have to be conscious and just watch.
Very, very small numbers have huge impacts. Wow.
But some of the tools that we have available to us now cost almost nothing. To get a microgram scale 10 years ago, there were only a handful of laboratory supply companies, and they were like $1,000 a piece. Now you can go on Amazon and get a functionally very reliable microgram scale for like $10 or $15. And it's digital. It comes with a proof weight. And so we find that those are functionally very accurate for the zinc dosing that we're doing. So scaling things is pretty easy. Measuring out your ingredients and precisely dosing zinc, I think, is fairly easy. But as Garrison mentioned, a lot of it is kind of, at least our dosing is done from kind of an academic approach. When I redid the calculation for how we were going to apply it in our brewery, I did assume a certain amount was coming from the base malt, that we were somewhere in the 100 parts per billion or 0.1 ppm range. And then I also assumed that the zinc crystals that we were getting were 22% elemental zinc by weight. And so I backed in the calculation from there and found that, just in the roughest sense, we're adding 1 gram of zinc in solution for every 10 barrels of beer that we produce, is kind of the rough translation of that, to get us to 0.3 parts per million or 300 parts per billion. is kind of the generally accepted sweet spot for most beers. But what I will say is you can make a really, really good economic argument for this too, in that we always had highly attenuated West Coast IPAs at Beechwood. Before we changed our zinc program, we were seeing 87% to 88% attenuation on all malt beers. This is purely silo malt. We're mashing on the cool side, but we've got very healthy Cal Ale. Everything else being equal and just changing the zinc dosing that we're doing, we're now seeing 91% to 93% apparent attenuation on all malt beers. And so we were able to back off our base malt like 7-8%. That's a huge savings over the year, especially the bigger your brewery is. I mean, that in and of itself could amount to tens of thousands of dollars in annual savings. You know, for my brewery, those savings are really significant.
The question I have, when you say that you're increasing performance, what do you define as that performance of a fermentation? You know, what are some of those kinds of, you know, key numbers, you know, key performance indicators that, you know, that you're looking for, you know, that would define success or less success?
Well, ultimately, does the beer taste good? And is it clean and aromatic? That would be the number
That's
one.
That's not quantifiable though, Julian. Come on, we need some numbers and data.
Okay, quantifiably, what do we look for? We look for shorter lag time. In other words, the fermentation is apparently active sooner. We see terminal gravity sooner. We see a more complete fermentation. We see a denser harvest at time of harvest. And we also see increased viability at time of harvest. So those are measurable things that you need very few tools to kind of quantify and get a general sense of.
I think one of the biggest faults people, you know, you'd find, you know, in competitions or beer festivals or, you know, just with craft beer in general, you know, between the okay, you know, beers, good beers, great beers, is under attenuated. So I think Julian hit it right there. It's like one of the parameters is seeing that attenuation change. I mean, one of the things zinc does is increase maltose and maltotriose uptake. So, you know, you get more of those carbohydrates in the cell. You get zinc working with the metalloenzymes to do those reactions better. You're going to have more complete reactions driving the chemistry towards finish. The trick though, you know, is not just adding it, but that zinc has got to get to a cell and then inside the cell. So that's why adding it after the tube removal is helpful, because chelation is what happens to metals with protein, and what you're doing is removing protein in the tube. So kind of naturally, I guess we'd expect that a lot would go away. Now we can measure, we know that. So, but a lot of things have been difficult to measure in wort because it's so complex. And so that's why it's taken longer too for some things. But so the enzyme, you know, this zinc has to find it get in cell, has to find an enzyme. And so homogenization, you've heard a couple times here, is so extremely important. Garrison mentioning adding it in line into the fermenter, that is your best practice if possible. Same with yeast, getting better distribution. But unlike yeast, enzymes aren't going to grow, right? They got to mix. At least yeast growth gets a population blooming. But with zinc, it's just, you know, you really got to get that distribution. So, which is something brewers didn't have to think about before, really, because nothing else besides yeast was added on the cold side. But this is just the beginning, I think, of us looking at what we can add on the cold side to improve fermentations, because the brewing industry is weird that we don't. I mean, it feels normal to us, but everybody doing yeast work, whether it's pharmaceutical or other industries, you're adding all sorts of things on the cold side. But for beer, we care about oxygen, we care about contamination. For historical reasons, very important that we have just not done that, but there are huge benefits if it can be figured out. And so that's what we're seeing right now. But the homogenization is going to be the key to for any enzymes and nutrients on the cold side to make sure they work.
How do you homogenize, Julian? Obviously, if they're dumping in the tank, are you fostering movement in that tank for that homogenization in any specific way?
Yeah. So our typical practice to fill most of our 45 barrel fermenters at the production facility, it's three turns on the brew house to fill those. Our typical practice is, and this is all done within, like all of those knockouts happen within an 8-hour period. So from the time the first turn goes into
No Drauflausen for you, all a single day.
Kind of Drauflausen. So that's how we do it. But typically the way it happens, first knockout goes into the tank, yeast gets injected in line just post heat exchanger. And so that gets homogenized with the first turn in the fermenter. And then when the second turn is going in, that's when we'll add the zinc kind of at the beginning of that knockout. So it does homogenize with that. I'm sure the zinc uptake starts happening almost immediately. After that second knockout, the third knockout usually goes in 4 hours after that. But it's typically the second turn where it goes in. And then if a beer is brewed over multiple days, which sometimes is the case for the sake of yeast growth or just the way that the schedule falls and how we have to stagger brews, we might split up that zinc dose over multiple knockouts. It depends on the beer, but most of the time, second knockout when the fermenter is getting its second of three fills.
And those yeast are creating some currents within the tank by themselves through the fermentation process and small heat generation that's also causing, creating some currents that help that homogenization.
I'm sure that's a contributing factor, but I think the biggest factor is really just the fact that we're pumping in wort. I mean, that's going to overcome any other kinetics of the yeast that are taking place that early in fermentation.
Yeah, I would agree. And the fact that you have more fills going, right? What I would not want to do, I mean, a lot of people will just add, they'll put fill the fermenter and they'll add it on the top through a top man way or something. And that I would recommend not doing. Because yes, you're going to get some turbulence in the fermentation, but it's just not enough to distribute that mineral zinc everywhere where it needs to be to get the best practice, best performance.
And Chris, to your point, when we do small batches of beer where there's only a single turn going into, like a 15 or 20 barrel fermenter, we'll knock out, once half of the volume is in the tank, we might drop that zinc solution through the top when we're still very actively, relatively vigorously pumping in worts. We're fairly confident we're getting the mixing then of,
funny story. I've been at a few breweries now watching this, and seeing what people are doing, even at our own brewery in Asheville last month. I was there when we brewed a American Light Lager. And we said, okay, what about, it was Bruzine D at that time, but where'd that go? Oh, I forgot. So we'll add it in the top. So since we're not used to, as an industry, kind of adding these cold side things, it's like, where is everything? And then I was at another brewery and I said, where is it? And they said, oh, it's in the cold room still. Well, they're halfway through the transfer. So it's kind of like assembling these things, getting used to a different kind of practice, getting your whole team to be doing it the same way so it doesn't have unpredictable results. It's just going to be a fun thing for us to all focus on and look at.
This homogenization and circulation within cold side tanks is something that, you hit on at various points of that during the fermentation and then after through dry hopping, because it's that, getting that kind of contact exposure and homogenization of the tank is important in all of those things. And so I know Russian River, you all have some tank technology that aids in that homogenization on the hop side, or when you're dry hopping. Do you use any of that for, if you're inline, you probably don't need to focus on mixture as much.
Well, I'll say, even at the pub, we don't have the luxury of those goose mixes you're referring to. And, we'll just add one extra T on the knockout rig, and we're still adding it in line, sight glass, double valve, and a little gas connection. And we can kind of meter that in line with gas and feel fairly confident. The mixer is an interesting point. We've thought of, what sort of creative ways could we use this, portable in-tank mixer. We've thought about it with hop flowables. We've thought about it with zinc as well. And, we kind of came up with this pump. We just so happened to have a peristaltic pump laying around. Just so happened we had an extra port in our knockout line. And it kind of came together pretty quickly and pretty low budget.
Interesting. Well, Chris, earlier you mentioned that these zinc additions, obviously promoting greater attenuation through your fermentation, help knock out some of the issue with hop creep. And I know that both Beechwood and Russian River are also using other techniques, specifically enzymes, as also a means of controlling and managing this while promoting fermentation. Let's talk a little bit about that piece. Julian, how then do you all use enzymes within the fermentation process to keep these healthy fermentations pushing forward and eliminate some of the potentially negative effects of later or lagging fermentation at the very end?
Well, I'm
or
a big
re-fermentation
fan.
Through dry hopping. Yeah.
Well, I'm a big fan of better brewing through science, and we use a whole host of enzymes at the brewery depending on the type of beer that we're brewing. But I would want to clarify that if you have an unhealthy fermentation from the beginning, it's really, really tough to kind of fix that, if you will, especially once things are fully attenuated or even halfway attenuated. There are very few levers that you can pull successfully. Occasionally they work out, but that's a very long technical conversation. But I think what you're getting at the most is probably the use of ALDC, alpha-acetolactate decarboxylase. And that is the enzyme which, if everybody is not using it, I think they should be using it in dry hop beers. There are some genetically modified yeast strains available that will produce that enzyme on their own. But that is the enzyme that helps clear that diacetyl pathway in fermentation, especially during dry hopping when fermentation is really complete and you're depending on just a little bit of healthy yeast still in suspension to complete that that hop creep related fermentation when you have those alpha diastase enzymes introduced from the dry hopping itself. And if there are breweries out there that say they don't get hop creep, they're either entirely brewing brut IPA or they don't know it. Because hop creep happens. Re-fermentation happens when you dry hop a beer. We have highly attenuated base beers that are completely absent of dextrin malt. They're mashed cool. It's not a very dextrinous wort. And we always see a rise in head pressure after we add dry hops. And that's not just CO2 coming out of solution. I thought that's what it was for a long time until people discovered hop creep. That's hop creep. That's re-fermentation that's happening. And every hop varietal is different. We have found certain hop varietals are much more problematic than others. And so for us, we use, in any beer that is getting dry hopped, we will not use any dextrin malt. We always use ALDC on the higher end of the dosing rate with our yeast. So it gets pitched at the beginning. And then depending on the dry hop, we will also add it with the dry hop. Beers that get brewed with Mosaic, my brewery will get it with a dry hop. If we dry hop with something like CTZ or Citra, we don't see the same type of hop creep. And, we've demonstrated this many times with lab tests. We don't see that latent diacetyl. So in some of those beers, we don't have to add ALDC with the dry hop. I think it's very hop varietal dependent. I think some of it is related to the alpha diastase amounts that are on the hop varietals. And I think some of it's also related to the polyphenol levels in the hops. And I can get into that deeper if you want me to.
I'm very curious.
String, are you? Okay. So I'll answer this one for Garrison. But I posited this hypothesis to Tom Shellhammer at Oregon State, and then Pat Jensen at Yakima Chief Hops a couple years ago. But we have two core West Coast IPAs. We've got Amalgamator, which is all Mosaic in the dry hop. And then we've got Citraholic, which is all Citra in the dry hop. And really, they're identical beers. It's a great example of what changing one hop varietal will do to the identity and flavor and aroma of a beer. But they're, on paper, they're the same beer. But whenever we would always notice a larger head pressure build in a amalgamator with Mosaic compared to Citraholic. Whenever we would send things to the lab, we're usually in detectable levels for our VDK and diacetyl. Usually our beers are testing sub 15 ppb, which is functionally undetectable. But if we ever did see any kind of like slight rise, like maybe 20 or 25 ppb or something at some point in the process, it was almost always in amalgamator, Mosaic hopped beer. And at the same time, we're a brewery that relies on finings to clarify beer. We use, you know, we use a silica-based fining. We don't filter. We don't use gelatin. We were noticing that Citraholic was requiring twice the amount, sometimes three times the amount of finings to clarify that beer. And I was pretty sure it was related to polyphenol levels. And so I had Yakima Chief run polyphenol tests on a whole bunch of our selected lots and then compared with just generic lots that they had on the shelf. But what they found is that almost across the board, Citra had a 30% higher polyphenol level than Mosaic, Simcoe, a lot of other common varietals. And I wondered if the polyphenols were somehow inhibiting that alpha diastase or some of that alpha diastase activity. And I did a little bit of research, and lo and behold, polyphenols are sometimes given as an oral dietary supplement for diabetics to slow diastase activity in the gut and slow uptake of carbohydrates and broken down sugars. And so my hypothesis is that polyphenol content also plays a role in hop creep and latent diacetyl.
Interesting. So by inhibiting the enzyme reaction.
I think it does inhibit it. And certainly we know anything about enzymes is that they can be inhibited, whether it's through temperature, whether it's through an anti-enzyme, something that will block the enzyme from latching onto whatever it's trying to cleave. But from a chemistry standpoint, it's certainly possible. And I think that's what we see, because we've never seen any latent diacetyl issues in beers that were dry hopped purely with CTZ, purely with Citra, but we've certainly seen it happen with Mosaic.
Garrison, what's your experience there? And how do you all manage using ALDC or other enzymes through that process to cut back or to fight against hop creep?
We support it. We're big enzyme users here as well. I think it's just another example how modern science has made better beer. But I will say another parallel, like economic potential of really dialing in your zinc is we cut our enzyme usage by 300% from an ALDC perspective because we had this fermentation deficiency that we felt like was being caused by lacking yeast nutrients, and we were looking anywhere from 6 to 8 to 9 days warm on hops waiting for this hop creep to finish and the diacetyl reduction to go. So brewers that, they just want to throw more at it. So we're just putting more ALDC in the tank. And, we got to this ALDC rate that was, frankly, unsustainable. And just through zinc usage, we were able to get that fermentation window much further down. And, now we're 5 to 6 days warm on hops where we get that same attenuation rate. We are trying to basically build a little bit of dextrin content in our wort so that we know we have a pre-dry hop attenuation target and then a final attenuation target because we're trying to keep a little more body in these beers. I think Southern California is definitely notorious for having, dry, bitter beers that people love and I love personally. But that's not always our brand profile. And so, we're targeting 2.4 to 2.6 finishing gravity on Pliny the Elder. So we buffer a little bit of dextrin capacity and we change our mash bill to kind of hit that pre-dry hop attenuation. And then we know based off the hop bill what our final attenuation should be. So obviously we have to still finish that fermentation out. We have clear VDKs. We run VDKs both on forced and on GC. So we're waiting for that threshold to drop, that gravity drop to, stop. But through zinc, we were able to kind of bring a lot of that down and go from a 8 days post dry hop to 5-6.
Like Julian, do you see hop variety impacting the way that you use enzymes or the way that there any dosage?
Absolutely, and I think the advent of some of these hop products is a real big deal. And concentrated pellets, and there's a lot of studies still ongoing as far as what part of the plant material is actually carrying those diastatic enzymes. We found that it was a lot of different places. So, but the concentrated pellets, we did find a lot less diastatic reduction.
Yep. And there have been a couple breweries that have done studies on this, but the current studies and indicators point to most of that alpha diastase being bound up in the green matter. There are a couple breweries out there that have extensive enough labs, and they've done studies where they brewed an IPA purely with cryo hops and measured less alpha diastase, seen less hop creep, seen less VDK. Everything has been diminished. But, I think cryo is an example of a great product, but I also view it as a supplemental product. And also, if you wanted to just eliminate hop creep by only dry hopping with cryo, that would get expensive too. Yeah, that would get expensive also.
And I think we know that we have to have like a full spectrum of hop products to create these beers. I don't think we can
totally
do eye drops or was of tinctures to create this hop profile and flavor sensation. We did find just changing varieties out in different formats. We saw a less attenuation change post dry hop.
So Mosaic is a big offender.
I think it is.
Are there any others that are like red flag hops where you're going to have to put some more work into these?
Amarillo, Cascade. I want to say this year we're going through maybe 40 pounds of Cascade and only on like red ale and brown ale. It's not something we typically dry hop with anymore. But another enzyme which I think brewers can use, and they may not necessarily think about it reducing hop creep. But any type of alpha glucosidase enzyme, we use both of those in a lot of our American kind of macro style lagers. And every once in a while, if we will brew like maybe a West Coast style beer, but with a less attenuative yeast, like let's say I want to use an English ale yeast in a West Coast style beer, we will hit the mash with amylo enzyme to ensure that it's as dry as something like Cal Ale. And I think if the drier your beer is, the more attenuated it is, the less likely you are to have issues with hop creep because there is less to ferment. I think, another enzyme that brewers should consider using to ensure a dry beer. And if you're worried about something being overly dry, well, you can make up for some of that by water treatment. You can kind of counteract some of those effects of something being bracingly dry by dialing in your finishing acidity, your finishing chloride levels. And so you have a lot of adjustable dials. But again, some type of alpha glucosidase, I think, is a good weapon to have.
Chris, are you seeing anything else in that enzyme space that the brewers are responding to? Or are you all, how are you all operating in that space?
We've been working a lot with enzymes for brewers before, but also the non-beer industries we work with in distilling and wine and, basically all the alcoholic fermented beverages. And, I started sort of more in enzyme chemistry than anything else. So I think they're fascinating. And there's a lot that's not supplied in malt, but they're still as natural. Brewers, again, are used to sort of everything coming in the barley, which is pretty awesome. Has to be converted a little bit to malted barley, but we're pretty lucky. But, the American light beer category was built on glucoamylase, and ours is ultra firm, and there's others, as Julian mentioned. But, Miller Lite, that was it, the first American version of that German technology patent that produced a lighter beer, because more carbohydrates were consumed, a drier beer. It was called light beer more because of the calories, but now you can talk about carbohydrates. People have that more in the vocabulary now, which is cool because that's really what matters. And the consumer is talking carbohydrates now. It's talking drier. Okay, you can talk carbs or calories, doesn't really matter, but it's getting more dispersed or whatever. But I think that's what's driving a lot of people to these other beverages outside of craft beer, you know, and it's not so much price. A lot of them are priced higher, but people, younger consumers are looking for lower calorie. And if you make them drier, that's the biggest thing for lower calorie. I mean, you can always adjust alcohol if you care about the calories there. But I think, you know, that's where these combinations of things might be important. And, you know, as I mentioned, that America Light lager that we just made last month, and we also made in San Diego, you know, we're using Ultra Firm to make a more fermentable wort and get it under one Plato. And you could water it back if you wanted to a little bit to control the alcohol, or use a lighter OG if you wanted to have a lower calorie or lower alcohol beer. A lot of fun things you could do there what Anheuser-Busch did with Bud Light, didn't want to do the enzyme. They just did a 3-hour mash. I mean, so there are things, they never got it as low as Miller Light, but there are things you can do with enzymes or with our mash profile. Like, it's not done after an hour, right? Just because the color turns, right? If you ever left a mash going overnight, you know, it ferments a lot more. So that, again, that's where enzymes come in. Like, yes, they work fast, but how long do you want them to work? How much substrate are they going to find? So it's a fascinating topic that probably is just getting to begin with for some craft brewers, and some people have been doing it for a long time.
Wes, I have a question for you related to ALDC. So as somebody who lives in California, I love wine. I love all types and all varietals of wine, but one that I find problematic are a lot of California Chardonnays, because they go through this massive malolactic fermentation, and that presents as just huge diacetyl in a lot of these wines. It's why when I gravitate towards a white wine, I go for something like a Sauvignon Blanc, which doesn't go through malolactic. But when I looked at the metabolic pathway of the malolactic fermentation, the uptake of diacetyl and the conversion of diacetyl looked almost identical, if not totally identical, to Saccharomyces. So could you do a malolactic fermentation with ALDC present and eliminate that diacetyl and still convert the malic acid to lactic acid?
Yes, I think so. I mean, no one's really asked me about that before. But
can you tell that to all the winemakers up in Sonoma and Napa, please? Garrison, that's your job now.
And all the peanut crossover, come on. But maybe they can do it. Yeah, you know, it's funny. Like, what brewers talk about is so departmentalized in brewing, and with our own vocabulary, what winemakers talk about. And our vocabulary is just different enough to make us sound weird talking to the other groups. But, you know, I'm certainly saying 30 years ago, but lots of things have already happened between groups now.
I'd be curious to see if anybody would be willing to try that at a winery, because there are certainly winemakers out there who do not like malolactic fermentation in their Chardonnays. I could think of several right now, but it is more common to do malolactic than to not with certain varietals. But I'd be curious to know if anybody would be willing to try it with ALDC.
Interesting. We're going to build a whole new audience for the podcast here amongst winemakers that want to talk to Julian about fermentation. Brilliant.
They don't want my input.
That guy? Oh, my God. Well, we've been talking for a while here. Let's kind of pull out as we finish up. You know, and just kind of bullet point it for folks. Garrison, you know, if you're thinking about fermentation and takeaway tips that brewers out there listening to this, you know, can focus on, you know, what are your top three things that, you know, that everybody out there listening who's brewing beer should be paying attention to? What are those three big takeaways that they should take?
Yeah. Clean wort, you know, look at your kettle findings, making sure you're separating things that should be separated. So I think that's a big thing straight off the top. You know, we're with Chris here. So I'm going to say, make sure you have good, healthy yeast at the right pitch rate, at the right viability. And then I'll ring one more bell for aeration. I think there's a lot of cool ways you can optimize the fermentation or try to get more or less yeast growth or more or less you know, flavor active metabolic compounds out of controlling aeration.
Julian, what are your top three takeaways?
I would echo what Garrison said, but I think before you even get to fermentation, figure out what inspires you and go to the source and have those things fresh. So you have a good sense of where the finishing line actually is. You can only brew a style so well by reading about it in the book, and chances are you'll be way off point. So you've got to go to the source to really understand how things are. So when you do start brewing things in your brewery, you understand how close or far away you are from a target. And to Garrison's point, healthy yeast is incredibly good. Clean wort is incredibly important as well. But consider playing around with enzymes, consider varying oxygen dosing rates on certain styles to control flavor and aroma profile, as well as fermentation temperature. I think a lot of people would be surprised where a lot of American macro lagers are fermented and how ester-driven a lot of those are. So a lot of things to consider.
Interesting, interesting. Chris, what are your big takeaways for brewers out there looking for healthy fermentations?
Yeah, I think, pitching rate's one of the important elements. But again, thinking about yeast growth, as we've been talking about, zinc, oxygen, if you can measure the oxygen, try to get closer to 1 ppm per Plato in zinc. And I'm sorry, we were just talking about if oxygen, rather than just a 7 or a 10, or flow rate. Those are important. And thinking about how attenuative your beer wants to be. If people keep complaining that the beers that aren't good are under attenuated, what can be done, especially without equipment? First of all, sometimes it's knowing that they're supposed to be fermented drier. I think of the Belgian beers that we started making in the US, and they taste fruity and they taste sweet. So people made them sweet. But, if you visit Belgium and, as people are doing, you visit the source, you're like, well, these are pretty darn dry, but they're fruity. That tastes sweet. Make fermentation create the flavors. Don't just make it sweeter. That's not what most consumers want today. And when they find out that coming back to the dryness, and, it's been a big topic for me most of my life. I'm a type 1 diabetic, and I've always had to think about carbohydrates and sugar. And I don't even like the word carbohydrates. I think it's a stupid word. People don't know what sugar. It doesn't matter what carbohydrate it is. It's sugar in our body in 20 minutes. So big deal. It didn't take 5 minutes. But we have amylase enzymes. We have everything to make in our mouth, So we have everything to break these things down, plus all the microbes in our body. So beer just lives in this world, and consumers are getting smart about what they're drinking. And so a better fermentation makes a drier product, gives you more metals at GABF, because that's what wins. It goes on and on and on. But because then the flavor shines through of your hops, of your malt, of your fermentation.
Don't just make it sweeter. Focus on that flavor. I think those are great words to wrap this up with. Thanks for joining all of us on this special fermentation focused episode of the podcast. Again, brought to you interruption free by our friends at White Labs. Visit whitelabs.com for more information. And if you've got a particular fermentation problem that you're trying to solve, reach out, because Chris's experts there at White Labs can help craft a solution for you. Chris, Julian, Garrison, thanks to all of you for joining your thoughts on fermentation and yeast health. It has been fantastic talking with you. Cheers.
It's an honor. Thank you, Jamie. Chris,
thank
Garrison.
You. Oh, man, that's a lot of fun. Appreciate it, guys. Thank you.
Cheers. Thanks, Jamie. Thanks, everybody.
This podcast has been brought to you by Craft Beer & Brewing Magazine, for those who love to make and drink great beer. To learn more or to subscribe, visit beerandbrewing.com or find us on social media at Craft Beer Brew.